You're listening to Explore by the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Find out more at iwalker.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk.
Welcome to Explore by the Cycling Podcast. This is our show dedicated to the world of bikepacking, adventure and endurance riding and record breaking. But it's not just a show about the longest rides and toughest riders, although there'll be plenty of that, I'm sure. This is about letting the bike explore the world, sometimes seeking the path less followed. After all, one person's century ride can be as challenging as another person's transcontinental. So we'll be hearing from all sorts of people who have traversed the planet on two wheels, and sometimes not even two wheels. But more of that in a later episode. Now, we launched Explore as a six-part series at the end of 2018, and we were stunned by its popularity and always planned to bring it back. But for one reason and another, it's taken us just over a year to get back in the saddle. And we're bringing the show back as a monthly instead of a six-part series. So, the intention is that the journey will never stop. And I'm delighted to say that continuing the continuity, if that's such a thing, we are joined again by Hannah Troop. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, Lionel. How are you doing? I can't believe it's been over a year. It feels like it's a long time, obviously, but it didn't feel like it was quite that long ago since we were doing it.
I know. Time flies, doesn't it? Have you managed to ride your bike much in the year and a bit since we recorded the first series of Explore?
Well, since we recorded that first series, life has changed quite a bit for me. I've actually relocated from London to Barcelona. And so now I have great weather and a lot of mountains around me to climb. So actually, I have been doing quite a fair bit of riding, I have to admit.
All right, don't rub it in. But you've embedded yourself in the world of cycling, haven't you? What have you been up to professionally in the last 12 months or so?
Yeah, so not only did I relocate country, I also started working for EF, Education First Pro Cycling, as part of their communications team. So I've been kind of like going along with their journey over the last year and spending a lot of time on the road with those guys.
Well, I'm sure we will find out a bit more about EF Education First as we go along, because, of course, several of the riders have done more than dipping their toe into the world of gravel riding over the past 12 months. And that's something that's going to continue, I gather. But there's a lot of crossover there between professional racing and the off-road gravel riding. And it's a trend that is becoming, it's catching on, isn't it? But we're not just focused on the elite end of gravel riding. We're not just focused on off-road riding either. If you remember back to the first series we did, we covered various different stories from the Transcontinental, which is the epic that goes across Europe. I think you spoke to James Hayden for that episode, didn't you, Hannah? We also heard from Rupert Guinness, who rode across Australia. Ned Bolting and I went on a very, very tough couple of days cycling from Cambridge to Southwold and back. I know that people were really impressed by the level of challenge that presented me, weren't they?
I think it was definitely one of the highlights, to be honest with you. It was record-breaking on so many levels.
Well, I wanted to establish in that first series, and we'll do so again, that this isn't just about the real hardcore cycling challenges out there. It's about adventure. I think a spirit of adventure underpins most of our stories that we've got lined up. We've got a long list of stories that I need to follow up on. Loads of people got in touch with us in the wake of the first series of Explore, suggesting ideas, people to speak to, and I've got a big list of those. And over the coming months, we'll work our way through some of those stories, and we'll also hear from different people out and about riding. One of the things that we want to do is get recording equipment into people's hands, so if they're off taking part in some epic ride somewhere in the world, they can keep an audio diary for us. But again, more of that a bit later on. This first episode, I wanted to establish that Explore really can be about any kind of cycling, and I've combined my own love of cuisine with a love of cycling. And I've spoken to somebody who did exactly that, combining a journey around France with the task of tracking down some of French cuisine's greatest recipes. I spoke to Felicity Cloak, who is a writer specialising in food and drink and the author of 6 cookbooks, a past winner of the Guild of Food Writers Awards and a Food Journalist of the Year. And she is the author of a very fine book called Another Croissant for the Road, which kind of gives away the subject of her book and her journey, which was a culinary tour de France. So a couple of weeks ago, I caught up with Felicity in what I had hoped would be a nice little cafe somewhere in London, but it was too small for our purposes. There was nowhere to sit, and so we ended up in a chain place just down the road, unfortunately.
You're listening to Explore by the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Just before we hear from Felicity, you'll have noticed at the beginning of this episode mention of the Cycling Podcast's new title sponsors, iWalker. Now, it's thanks to iWalker's support that we've been able to bring back Explore as a monthly show. Although the podcast's free to listen to, it's not free to produce more than 150 episodes every year, and so we're delighted to have such significant support from iWalker. Like you, iWalker are fans of cycling, and they also listen to the podcast because that's how this sponsorship deal actually came about. They got in touch with us after hearing that we were on the lookout for a new title sponsor for this year. So who are iWalker and what do they do? Well, they lend money to small businesses to keep the wheels turning when a company needs finance, whether it's to face a financial challenge that comes up every now and again, or buy stock in bulk, or expand, recruit new staff, or just cover costs during the low season. iWalker was founded in 2012, so they're only a year older than the Cycling Podcast, and in that time they've made finance available to more than 50,000 businesses across Europe. They can lend between £1,000 and £250,000, and they make it quick and easy to get a decision on the loan. Among the businesses they've lent to are bike shops and cafes, spin studios, hair salons, building companies, well, pretty much every type of small business you can think of, really. And over the coming weeks and months, we'll hear more about what iWalker do, as well as find out more about their very keen interest in cycling. But in the meantime, if you're interested in finding out more about what iWalker can do for small businesses, go to iwalker.co.uk. That's iwoca.co.uk. And we're very, very happy to have iWalker with us as we set out on this new season of Explore. And well, are they coming off-road with us? Are they exploring the world with us, or tucked in our handlebar bags? I'm not quite sure, but we're very happy to have them along with us for the ride. Now let's go to a coffee shop in central London where I met up with Felicity Cloak. So Felicity, welcome to Explore by the Cycling Podcast. We arranged to meet in a very nice little patisserie cafe called Au Pain de Papy, just on Gray's Inn Road here in central London. It's a very small place. It smells delicious and buttery in there. I did want to stay, but unfortunately it was too small. There's only really a counter in the window and some people already sitting there. I thought they'd be earwigging the podcast before it's aired. And it's too cold. It's early January. It's freezing cold and wet outside. So we've come just along the road to a chain cafe. I won't name the chain cafe, but I brought my artisan coffee. I'm going to surreptitiously drink that before I move on to my flat white here. And you brought a bag of madeleines, Felicity. Yeah. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Yeah, they're brown butter madeleines, because one of the dishes, actually, I went to Commissy in the Lorraine, where apparently the madeleine originated. And actually, I bought a bag of madeleine there, and I was really glad I did, because they sustained many lunch stops where there was no lunch in that area of France. I found it quite hard to find things that were open, certainly in the Champagne region. And so I was eating those madeleines for many days afterwards. But these ones are fresh from the oven. They're not squashed in a panier. I mean, they're a little bit squashed, but...
Well, they'll be squashed once they've gone back in my bag, but thank you very much. Now, the trip you went on is kind of the very definition of explore to me. I'm at the sort of softer end of the cycling spectrum when it comes to going off on my bike, and your trip really appealed to me because it combined my two twin passions, cycling and food. So I guess the first thing to find out is, what came first? Was it the food or the cycling?
The food, in the sense that I've always been, well, I've not always been a cyclist, but, you know, as the kind of person that you move to London, you realise that actually the quickest way to get around London is by bike. So I always had a bike, but I never really went any further than the pub. Obviously, I left my bike at, you know, outside the pub. I would never cycle after having a drink. But then about 5 years ago, I was sort of suffering from a terrible broken heart, and a friend of mine said, "We're cycling to Brussels. Do you want to come?" And I was like, "No." But then I suddenly thought, this is a really good time to do a stupid thing. So I was like, "Okay, fair enough. Let's do it." Bought a new bike, snazzy bike, it was a hybrid rather than a Paschali, so that felt snazzy to me at the time. And I had the best trip ever. I just had so much fun. And that sort of gave me the bug. And then, you know, went to Brittany, Tuscany. And then in 2017, another friend, I have a lot of slightly mad friends, it turns out, was moving back down to Provence, where her family are from, and she decided that she was going to cycle there, which doesn't sound that mad, except she didn't even own a bike in London. She literally, I don't know what gave her this idea. And so she said, "You want to join?" And again, I was like, why not? And so I joined this group of mostly complete strangers, and we did the Vélodyssée down from Brittany to Bordeaux, and then we went across the Mediterranean coast and ended up at Sète. And again, 3 weeks of just the most wonderful experiences. And I thought, along the way, because obviously you get a lot of time to think when you're cycling, especially when you're not, you know, racing, which I never am. And I thought, how can I turn this into my job? So when I got back, I said to my agent, "Do you think that there's a, you know, could I combine the thing that I already do with food and cycling? Do you think there's a market for that?" And thank God, she said, "Yes, I think there might be." And so it was basically just a way to have holidays and call it work. Yeah.
Well, I think that's what we're all doing, really, on the Cycling Podcast. I don't want to admit that too publicly, but just roll back a little bit. Your trip to Brussels, Flanders is a tremendously underrated region for both cycling in the broader sense. I mean, cycling fanatics will know all about the classic races, of course, but also for food. I mean, I've been going to Flanders for 20 years and can't beat a Flemish stew and all the frites and mayonnaise. I mean, you know, it can be quite difficult to get back on the bike after a big lunch.
I think the problem we had, and this is a problem that recurs on all of my cycle touring, apart from the UK, which I would say this is one of the things the UK does best, is I fell foul of the opening hours in both France and Belgium. So I remember one time sort of chipping up at quite a sizable town to see them packing up the Saturday market. And every, you know, I literally saw the chip van driving off, and there was nothing apart from to go to the, you know, the bar to back, and one of those menus where you look at it and you think, what is the least bad thing on this menu? What can they not screw up? And so I think I ended up with a frozen baguette pizza, which, you know, it hits the spot. It's carby, it's fatty, it's salty. But it wasn't what I was hoping for in terms of moule and frites and etc. But in general, we did eat quite well, but there was a lot of frites going on and a lot of beer in evenings.
Well, I remember a trip to Flanders where we had exactly that same problem in Oudenaarde, where we had a leisurely beer over what was turned out to be the cafe's lunchtime, and then by the time we were ready to order food, they'd stopped, and the guy said, you know, very droll, very deadpan, "But we're still serving beer till 3 like, whoa, great. But on to your Tour de France, how did you kind of, I mean, it's quite an undertaking. I mean, just setting off on your own with a bike and a route that you'd plotted out on a map spread out on the table. I love the fact that the book starts with going and buying the map from Stanford's, where, you know, the internet has maps now, but I can get, it sets the tone and the scene for the type of journey you wanted to go on.
Yeah, I love a map anyway, but it's not the same. I wanted to see the whole of France. And what I appreciated when I got that map, and it does make me sound like an idiot, but it's true. I've been going to France my entire life, since before I could remember. You know, my parents are massive Francophiles. but I hadn't really appreciated how large France was as a country. And when it was spread out on my floor, because it was too big for my table, I did appreciate that quite quickly. But yeah, I went to buy a map, and then I sort of made a list of the things that I thought were French classics that were either relatively well known in this country already, because I wanted it to be quite a nostalgic trip for the British audience, because I think that French food has been quite underrated in the last 20 years. But also I wanted some things that I thought should be better known in this country, you know, outside the sort of foodie set. And so I made a big list of that, and obviously it was very hard to narrow that down to 21 because French food is incredible. And then I tried to plot them around, sort of in a rough circle around the country. And I also tried to get quite a mix of, you know, sweet and savoury meat, fish and vegetables. And you might not be surprised to know that vegetables fell slightly by the wayside in that. There's a ratatouille in there. And there's sweet things that contain no gizzards or, you know, pieces of fish. But it's quite a meaty book. So, yeah, but that was fun in itself. And then the route plotting was sort of fun and sort of torturous. I enjoyed it at the beginning, and then in the end I was like, I'm just going to work it out as I go along. Which turned out to be the best policy. But I started off with incredibly detailed directions, and then it's not working.
It seems like you're plotting your own Tour de France route, like Christian Prudhomme and the team, you know, but you're choosing, instead of the Alps and the Pyrenees and where to go, choosing by the dishes you wanted to sample. Was there kind of like a three or four dishes that you knew absolutely had to be on the course, a bit like, you know, Mont Ventoux or Alpe d'Huez, you know, the tour's not quite the same without them?
Well, funny you should mention the Alps. I did want to do Tartiflette, so I knew that there was going to be an alpine stage in there, and I also knew that that would bring with it challenges as well as eating a Tartiflette in June. And so that was a given. I wanted to do something like a bouillabaisse because, you know, it felt iconic to me. I think, yeah, a cliche, but the Alps, the Haute-Savoie and the Var are my two favourite regions of France, obviously because I've been on holiday there lots. And so I wanted to see those two things, but I also wanted to see things that maybe weren't solely French, so maybe to have some of the Basque influence. I really wanted to go to Alsace, and that was probably my favourite region of this particular trip. And, you know, just to maybe try and get some of the Italian influence on the Côte d'Azur as well. But yeah, I wanted the classics. I wanted a croissant recipe in there because I was eating a lot of croissants. I wanted the bouillabaisse and the steak frites and the oysters and things. So yeah, it was sort of half and half things that I felt I couldn't leave out and half things that I personally wanted to learn more about and felt this was a good opportunity.
Were you setting the route out trying to have the fine dining experience, or because you're on a bike and traveling you know, pretty self-sufficiently, was there a lot of compromise that came into it as you set off on, you know, because you've got to cover the ground, can't carry a great deal with you? I mean, how did you kind of marry up the cycling with what you wanted to do professionally, which was, you know, right, engagingly about the food? Because I've often found the funniest stories about the disasters, but you can't just write a book celebrating French cuisine with only 21 stages of disasters.
I mean, it was a near thing. It was quite hard just because clearly on a bike you have relatively limited flexibility. In a car it's very easy to take sort of a 200-kilometre detour across Brittany to eat the best crepe in France. But in that, it really, on a bike, you know, you're taking 2 days out and then you find yourself somewhere that you don't want to be for the next stage in the Loire Valley. And so there were certainly some compromises, and I'm sure that if I had a year to plan it and had 6 months to do the trip, I could have, you know, found better examples of the thing. I could have talked to more people, because actually there's no substitute for being on the ground and asking people what they think, who they'd recommend to talk to. And it was just France. I get the sense, to a slightly lesser extent in the UK, things are still not online, and so you really have to go there and talk to people to find out. And I tried to do quite a lot of research before I went, but, you know, I was also trying to do all my work for while I was away, and I was trying to brush up my French and, you know, buy a new bike and et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, there were certainly some compromises. But as you say, a lot of the bits that people are tell me they enjoy most are the bits where I was at complete rock bottom. And there was one chapter in the Limoges where my editor's notes was, "Did anything good happen in this stage, please? It's really miserable." And I thought, well, the thing is, it rained. I mean, it rained continuously for the first 3 weeks of my trip, which was really galling because here we were having a heat wave and I kept getting sent photos of my dog sort of sunbathing in Buckinghamshire, and I was under canvas in the Limousin just drenched. So it kept raining. I had a really mediocre steak in Limoges, which was the whole reason I'd gone to Limoges. Everything was closed. And then someone said to me, if you're in that area, you really ought to go to Oradour sous Glan, the site of a notable Nazi massacre. And when someone says that, you feel like you ought to go. And I felt like I couldn't say, oh no, I don't have time, because actually I was basically there looking at cows. So I went, and I'm glad I went, but it's obviously... You can't, there's nothing to be extracted from that except, you know, this is awful. And so the whole chapter, and then when I got back to the campsite, there was a swarm of killer hornets. so the whole thing, and then the sort of the washing machine sort of exploded on my kit, and I just, it was really, really grim. But, you know, people enjoy that kind of thing. Everyone loves suffering vicariously. It's why I, you know, enjoy reading sort of cycling biographies, because I really like hearing about people sort of expiring on the cobbles. I don't want to do that myself, but it's nice to read about it, isn't it?
There's no triumph without disaster, no joy without suffering. I mean, that's the lesson of cycling. And I think that's probably the lesson of touring around trying to sample a country's cuisine as well. There's, in France, as everywhere, there's exceptional to really... terrible, and the thing that offends me most about the food is the kind of the mediocre that's really overrated. But we'll come on to that, because I just wanted to ask about Oradour sous Glan, just in case listeners aren't aware. It, as you say, it was the site of a Nazi massacre in the Second World War, and I visited there on a bike as well when the Tour de France went close by. And again, one of those things, I'm so close, I really ought to go and see it. Not really thinking things through, arriving in cycling shoes and kind of clacking about really awkwardly and feeling very uncomfortable that this was sort of disrespectful. I took them off in the end, so I wasn't sort of clacking about so embarrassingly in my cycling shoes. But a real kind of you learn something about French history, or, you know, 20th century French history, just from visiting that site, which they have left more or less as the Nazis left it, haven't they?
It was, I mean, I'm now feeling ashamed I didn't take off my cycling shoes. It was raining, in my defence, and there were a lot of French teenagers that were not treating the site incredibly respectfully, but they're teenagers. But yeah, it's just extraordinary. The whole thing has been left, and, you know, you can see details because it's quite... You know, we're all used to, I suppose, in Europe, going to historical sites. You know, you do it for school, you might do it at the weekends. But it's rarely something that's so recent. And so you'd see the electricity wires still sort of dangling. You'd see the blue and white enamel street signs. There was a rusting bicycle, I noticed. You know, everything is just like the villages you've just cycled through, except in ruins. And it's incredibly affecting as a visit. It really was. It sort of sent shivers down my spine. It's just so, yeah, I'm glad I did it, but all the way home back to the miserable campsite, I sort of in a very reflective mood. And then the sun finally came out, and also I nearly ran over a snake in the road, and that sort of obviously that stopped me short, because I was like, wow, a snake in the road. But also I thought that's a sort of harbinger of the fact that I'm moving south, which felt like progress to me, in the sun and the snake, and I sort of felt actually that was quite... Then I went to an enormous Leclerc and bought dinner, and was distracted by all the amazing things that Leclerc has. And so, you know, it's easy on those trips to move from lows to highs quite quickly. But I'm definitely glad that I went.
As I polish off a double espresso to fortify me for the afternoon ahead, I get chatting to the men opposite, who work in an office nearby. "Do you always come out for a proper lunch?" I ask, curious. They laugh. "Oh, yes. Normally," the younger one says, "we have champagne, white wine, red wine, cognac, the works." "Then straight back to work," his companion adds, chuckling. "No, seriously though, sandwiches, fast food, they're no good for you. You need a proper lunch. It's normal here." I tell them that when I worked in offices in the UK, most people would eat lunch at their desks, Tupperware by the keyboard. They visibly shudder at the prospect, delighted by this tale of barbarism across the channel. The coffee feels like necessary fortification. Seeing that I'm in Limoges from my endless cow photos on social media or online, several people have strongly recommended a visit to Oradour-sur-Glan, the site of a Nazi massacre in June 1944, and, according to one friend, a place everyone should visit once in their lifetime. To be honest, I've always had mixed feelings about the idea of including such places in a tourist itinerary, but to swerve it now feels cowardly, so I set off, dragging my pedals with reluctance to face the horrors ahead. I'm not wrong either. This isn't the right place to even try to sum up the experience, but I'm glad I went. The village has been left exactly as it was at the end of the war, by order of General de Gaulle, as a permanent reminder of the barbarity that happened there. The entrance, marked by a huge stone plaque bearing the words "Souviens-toi," remember. Beyond sit roofless houses, tangles of rusted bicycles and cars, a baker's shop with powdery coals still in the oven, melted telegraph wires, and streets marked by familiar blue and white enamel signs. There's no real need for the notices requesting silence. It's impossible not to come out deep in brooding thought.
Just on the cycling aspect, how experienced a cyclist were you before you set off on this trip, and did you train for it, and what kind of bike were you riding?
So, an experienced cyclist in that I'd done a bit of cycle touring, but nothing of this length, and nothing that would involve anything like, you know, the Col du Plan or anything like that. So I was a bit worried about that. But my general mode of operating in life is just to start and see what happens. I did intend to train more, but I decided to buy a new bike. So I had this bike that I absolutely loved, which was a Mango Point R. It was neon yellow. I absolutely loved it. Taxi drivers always stopped me to talk about it, which is better than most interactions with taxi drivers in London. And then it got written off by couriers coming back from Marseille in 2017. So I needed to buy a new bike, and this seemed like an excuse to write some of that bike off against tax. And so I went, a friend of mine who spends a lot of money on bikes had just bought a Condor. And so I was like, I'll just go down to the Gray's Inn Road and have a look. And it's like going and looking at some puppies. You don't come out of that shop without having bought a bike. But when I went and they did all the measuring up, and I went for a Condor Fratello, because it was sort of, I was carrying quite a lot of luggage, but I didn't want something, I'm also really shallow, and so I didn't want something that looked like any kind of like load, too much like a load-bearing bike. I wannedit to look cool when I got back, and I took the pannier rack off, basically. So that was my choice. Got it in Paris green. And they kept saying to me, what do you want? And I was like, what's the colour? Can you show me what the colour is? And so they measured me up, and it was brilliant. And I felt really excited. And then they said, so it should be ready for you sort of second week in June. And I was like, oh, God, the ferry is booked for, you know, bank holiday in May. So very kindly, they expedited it for me. But it meant that I didn't really have time to do much training on it. And the only bike I had at that point was this Paschley bike that weighs sort of 15 kilos without anything in it. So I went to a few spinning classes, which I really hate. But that was probably about it. And also I because in my day job I'm testing a lot of recipes for the Guardian, in theory I was going to get really fit sort of, you know, for this, but actually I was just eating the whole time, and so training very, very little. But it was interesting. Obviously I started off in Normandy, and then I worked my way through to the Alps. So the first sort of serious climbing didn't come until I was in the Basque Country, and that by then I definitely noticed looking down that my thighs looked more like Bayon hams, and so clearly something was happening. And I also noticed, because people did come and join me for various stages, and I noticed that I just found it a lot easier than they did, which obviously was really gratifying for me.
Invite all your friends out to France for a couple of days and then give them a good hammering on the
exactly,
bike.
Exactly, just humiliate them. Except when I got to Nice, a friend of mine was out there for the weekend riding in the hills behind Nice. And he said to me, oh, do you want to come out? I think I met him on the Friday and I was going up to the Alps the next day. But he said, oh, do you want to come for a ride with us in the hills? And I was like, I could go for a ride with those guys, or I could actually just have a swim in the sea, because I knew that this was the last time I was going to see the sea on this trip. So then I was heading up. And so I was like, no, I think not. Because also there's that fear that actually I was going to turn out to still be really unfit. So, yeah, I've ducked out of that one. But what I found fascinating was when I did the Jouplin, I had no idea whether I could actually do it or not. Because, you know, I'd read lots of people had sent me sort of more cycling, serious cycling friends had sent me sort of, you know, accounts of it and their opinions on it and things. And so I sort of knew, I'd done my research like a good journalist, but I set off not knowing if I was going to be able to do it or if it was just impossible hubris. And so that was interesting because I think that you don't get that much in adult life where you start something and you don't know how it will go. So that was probably the most... one of the best days of my trip because I did do it and then I got to eat a massive tartiflette on the other side in Morzine and then come back on the Route de Grande Alpes, which was just stunning, and I had an ice cream as well. Just the whole thing was brilliant.
The Jouplan, of course, the climb that Lance Armstrong said gave him the most difficulty in the tour. It's got a hard side and a really hard side. And tartiflette, for those who don't know, I mean everyone should know about tartiflette, but basically sliced potatoes and very gooey cheese and cream and lardons. And, well, I mean, you're the chef, so what makes a perfect tartiflette?
So I think that you need waxy potatoes for a start because you want to sort of keep their shape. You don't want it to be a cheesy mashed potato. You know, that's more sort of aligot territory. And then the bacon is optional, but it does give a really nice sort of salty, smoky, if you want, flavour to it. And then a little bit of garlic, bit of white wine, some cream. Again, not everyone uses cream, but because you have the cheese, and the cheese is the only, apart from the potatoes, the only thing you must have, and you have to have reblochon. What's interesting about it is it feels like a very ancient dish, and I also like going to the Alps in the winter, and you know it comes out in a sort of earthenware dish, and you feel like these people have been making it since time immemorial. When I started researching it, I realised it was actually an idea dreamt up by the reblochon marketing board in the 1980s. But what a genius idea. You cut a reblochon in half, and it's a cheese probably about 6 inches across. And you cut it in half laterally, and then you sort of drape a bit in the middle and a bit on top, and it just melts in the oven and covers the potatoes and all the rest of the good stuff with molten cheese. I mean, it's amazing. I have to say in June, and again, it was hot by that point, even in the mountains, it did make me break out into a small sweat. But, you know, I'd already just climbed this thing. And then I actually found coming down into Morzine more harder for me as a slightly nervous descender than going up. And so by that time I came down and I sort of, you know, those little French beers that they do, I just had sort of two of those in quick succession, and then I had the tartiflette. But yeah, it's still good. It goes down well at any time of year.
What was the kind of the longest day you did on a bike? I mean, were you conscious that you had to get to certain places by certain times?
So I did have certain deadlines where I was meeting people, or I didn't do much in the way of sort of reserving things before I went, mostly through a lack of planning rather than spontaneity. But things like I identified the place that was, you know, the guy that had run the best crepier in Brittany and therefore France. And he was right out in Finisterre. Of course he was. So on the furthest edge of Europe. And so I made a reservation there because I read lots of TripAdvisor reviews of people saying they were turned away. And, you know, it's a very, you know, it's just a creperie. It's nothing fancy. He has no airs and graces. But I imagined cycling all the way there and then being turned away. And I thought, great anecdote for the book, but also terrible for me. And so I did make a reservation, and they were somewhat bemused because they were closed for the winter when I made the reservation. And I turned up, and it was, I think, like a Tuesday or a Wednesday morning. It was the first time that I could have got there. And the restaurant, there was one table occupied. I think it was 12:05 on a rainy Wednesday morning in May. And they were like, oh yes, you're the lady that made the reservation. But it did fill up, so I was glad that I'd done it. But apart from that, I didn't do too much planning in advance. But I did find it frustrating that I had to go and meet people, or I had to be somewhere at a certain point, because it meant I couldn't, if I found something interesting, you know, there was a point, and French opening hours are a recurring theme in the book, So I'm a little bit like a broken record on the subject. But, you know, I was in Bayonne and I wanted to go to the chocolate museum. And I arrived there in the pouring rain. Bayonne was being dug up. Everywhere was being dug up on my trip. And so I arrived there and they said, oh, no, sorry, we're closing in 20 minutes, so you can't come in. And I was so soaking wet and angry. And I'd just fallen down the stairs at Bordeaux Railway Station and my bike had landed on top of me. And so I think I did start crying. It was a traumatic time. And the woman was lovely about it. She said, don't worry, madame, you can come back tomorrow. And I said, I can't come back tomorrow. I need to be in Pau tomorrow. So there was a bit of that. But the longest days I did were often involuntary because I decided, you know, that because France is so large and I was on a time constraint, that I would take trains as well, which I'm a bit of a completist, so that annoyed me, but it was necessary. And obviously the tour takes luxury buses, so why shouldn't I take a train?
I did love that little bit of self-justification very early on in the book. But it, again, give people the context and, yep. And then they come on the journey with you.
Exactly. So my problem was that I was intending to take the train in France under Macron. And so the whole summer was a summer of strikes, which I was aware of before I went. But the way that the strikes operated, there were 2 days a week. You know, it's very well organised, to be fair to them. 2 days a week, but you wouldn't know which trains are running until, I think, 7 p.m. the night before. And in the north, actually, that wasn't a great, you know, probably 40% of trains were running in the north. In the south, nothing was running. All stations were deserted. There were big sort of bed sheets outside Carcassonne Station with big strikers' slogans and etc. So I realised that there were bits that I'd intended, because they offered nothing of particular culinary interest and I needed to be somewhere, I would train it, that actually I ended up cycling it. And they, just because I felt that I shouldn't be doing this, there was a particular bit between Pau and Toulouse, which I'd intended to get the train and be in time for a nice cassoulet and etc. And I ended up cycling it, and the terrain sort of, you know, it's right at the beginning of the Pyrenees. It was just relentlessly up and down all day. It was torrential rain in the morning. I got sprayed with muck from some van of pigs. I had this chocolate from Bayonne. I found a snail on it in my panniers. It just awful. And then in the lunchtime, I had some stale lunch. And then from the day before, I feel sad thinking about it. And then in the afternoon, the sun came out in a relentless beating way. I ran out of water. Everything, all the villages around, picturesque, completely dead. You know, I was knocking on people's doors and no one was answering if they were there. And when I got to the campsite, it was mosquito infested. The woman had gone home for the evening, so I had to ring her. And when she came, she was so nice, but everything was closed in the village for dinner. And so I was depressed by that point. Like I said, I'd done, I think that was 166 kilometres, which was my longest day. She said, what were you hoping for dinner, madame? And I was like, I don't know, even a bag of crisps. And I was setting up my tent in this swamp, and with the buzzing of mosquitoes, covered myself in DEET. And she came back from her house. She'd gone home and she came back, driven back with a big bag of those lovely olive oil, you know, nice, really nice French crisps. I would have taken anything, but they were really nice. And she said, you know, I'm sorry, I don't have more to offer you. And I just started crying again. I didn't send all of it crying, but the emotion of it was such. So I spent that night after the 166 kilometres eating an enormous bag of crisps and some quite old Milka in this sort of deserted laundry room in a campsite and drinking vast amounts of water covered in DEET. And that was, yeah, that was a weird night because, A, she'd been so nice that I felt cheered. And I knew I was going to Toulouse tomorrow. I'd get to eat a cassoulet. It was great. On the other hand, this didn't seem like ideal refueling in the situation. So, yeah, the trains caused me problems.
Well, we'll take a little lunch break from my conversation with Felicity Cloak. Feel the need to refuel before the second part of our conversation. And it's time to introduce another regular contributor to the revamped, relaunched, new, improved, possibly, who knows, Explore series. And that is Ian Boswell, former professional rider with Katusha Alpecin, of course, who, if you listen to the regular episodes of the Cycling Podcast, you will know that he has taken the decision to retire, a decision partly enforced by successive head injuries. He's sustained concussions, and so he is retiring from pro road racing, but his cycling adventures are not ending, not by a long chalk. He is going to be exploring the world on two wheels, racing and riding off-road. And I spoke to him again a little bit earlier this month to find out what he has planned and what we might hear about in future episodes of Explore. Welcome to Explore, Ian.
It's good to be here, Lionel. Thanks for having me.
Well, where in the world are you at the moment?
I'm in Vermont. I'm not at my house. I'm actually down at a neighbor's house because our Wi-Fi is too slow to sometimes take calls and definitely to upload and send any sort of podcast file.
So you're fairly remote where you are? Or is it just not well connected?
We're definitely remote. But for some reason, the broadband cable internet ends like just at my neighbor's house, so we're still on DSL, so it's definitely slow anytime I'm trying to load a video or watch Netflix, or if I'm on Sufferfest, it's like sometimes I got to make sure that all the other devices in the house are off if I want to have a good crack at it.
So what's the weather like over there? We're talking in mid-January.
Yeah, it's been cold. We had some temps over the weekend, like a minus 14 degree day Fahrenheit. So that's, goodness, I don't know, minus 20 Celsius. We're in the heart of winter right now. And, it's beautiful. We got a bunch of snow. We probably have, 10, 12 inches of snow on the ground. So it's beautiful. Today's actually sunny, but it's around 0 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's, some frigid temperatures outside.
And what have you been up to? Because I imagine your routine this January is slightly different to what you've been used to in the last 7, 8, 10 years.
Yeah, this is actually the first time I've ever been in Vermont and at my house in the month of January, because I've always gone back to Europe just after Christmas, before New Year's for training, and then usually for a training camp that comes in January. So it's definitely a different routine, and it's kind of forced me to be a bit more dynamic in how I try and ride my bike.
Well, what have you been doing? Have you been able to, is it practical to go out in those temperatures? I mean, you're not worrying about, getting sick perhaps as much as you would have been when you were racing as a pro on the road. But was these conditions been something you would have avoided back in, the last few years?
Definitely. That's like one of the biggest changes as far as like bike riding I've noticed since, choosing to walk away from elite road racing. Before, I remember years past, like really panicking this time of year, or around late December, just being so worried about making sure I get in this specific training. And because it was so specific, oftentimes I would jump inside on and ride inside just because I knew I had specific work to do. It became very difficult to get the volume in at times, when you see everyone else in Spain or California doing 5-6 hour rides. That's a long ride to do inside. Some people can do it, but maybe mentally need more stimulation than riding inside. So it's definitely forced me to, kind of seek new ways to ride my bike. And ironically enough, I've been fat biking a lot, which is actually something I don't know why I didn't pick up earlier in my, road racing career, because, I was out yesterday and did a 4 hour fat bike ride. I only did about 40 miles because, the speeds are slow, but, it's amazing what you can do on a bike, if you have the right equipment, but then if you also just aren't so worried about all the details of, doing specific intervals, just getting out and riding with friends was awesome.
So that's the kind of cycling you've been doing this winter. Have you kind of rediscovered your kind of fledgling relationship with the bike in a way?
Yeah, definitely. I've always loved riding my bike, and even when I was, racing on the road, which is not that long ago, I still loved riding my bike. I loved the process of, getting ready to ride and, keeping your equipment clean and preparing and planning. But it was always very objective, based and very goal driven. And, now it's much more of a, kind of a, I don't know, I'm kind of flannering a bit, I guess, where I'm still riding my bike, but it's more, there's not as much regiment to my time window. When I was racing, I kind of set a limit on, like, if I don't ride by 10, usually I wouldn't have the motivation to get out and ride. And now with having a full-time job with Wahoo and also, so many other kind of side things going on, I'm sneaking in rides whenever I can, which is, it's been really eye-opening to realize that, I don't have to ride my bike at 10 o'clock in the morning and I can still get out and ride and, like I said, ride my bike in different capacities as well, which has been awesome. And I'm more inclined to explore more and ride different roads because I'm not so worried about, you know, getting specific work done.
So what does the year ahead look like? Because the style of cycling you're going to be doing is going to be very different, but I imagine you're still going to be out on a bike a lot of the time.
Yeah, so I'm I'm going to be participating in a lot of these alternative events in the US. So my first event is actually coming up here pretty quickly out in Boulder, Colorado on the 9th of February. It's the Old Man Winter Rally, so I'll definitely be prepared for the wintry conditions. But it's a gravel event. So I would assume that the first time I actually ride my gravel bike in the new year will probably be at this event. Just because with the conditions I have here at home, it's not really conducive to be riding a gravel bike. My fat bike with studded tires is much more adequate for the conditions.
So have you already kind of set yourself an events calendar for the year? You're completely in control of your own destiny, I guess.
I have, yeah. I mean, I have, prior to the announcement last week, together with Wahoo, we had a calendar pretty well mapped out. And since the announcement, a lot of other events have actually reached out and asked me if I could attend. I'm trying to keep my events to a pretty, try to keep a pretty clear calendar. One thing I struggled with racing on the road was that, you have this calendar that's kind of always changing just based off, team dynamics and courses and injury and whatnot. But actually even Steve Cummins reached out to me after my announcement and he said, "Hey man, you want to go down to do Cape Epic?" And I was like, "Ooh, that actually sounds pretty cool," especially to do it with Steve Cummins. So there are a lot of events on the calendar, whether it's gravel or fat biking, bike touring, so there's a lot out there to be explored, and I'm kind of just entering this world of, riding your bike in a different capacity than just sticking to paved roads.
Have you got like a little checklist of things that you would like to do? Maybe not this year, but certainly, over the next maybe 2 or 3 years?
Well, that's something I definitely need to work on, is just being patient, because to a degree, I kind of feel like there are a lot of opportunities right now to attend all these events, and I'm eager to enter this new space and to ride as much as I can and to ride my bike in different capacities. I would love to do Cape Epic at some point. There's another race in the US, like the Trans Rockies. That's an off-road self-contained mountain bike event that goes from the Canadian border down to the Mexican border. And I would love to do that at some point. I've never done a bike ride over 7 hours. And some of these events are multi-day adventures, so definitely got some preparation to do. And there's a couple people up here in northern Vermont that do a lot of bike touring and kind of those longer endurance events that I could kind of pick their brain and get some information about and just learn about the events and which events might suit me.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big world out there. I mean, there's so many different things to do, but I'm wondering whether does it feel like it will be a substitute for the sort of the competitive element of elite road racing? Because you are competing whether your job for the day is trying to get in breaks and win the race or not. Regardless of that, you are still part of a team of people who are competing in those events. And I guess there's a competitive element to all of these other kind of events, but will you feel like it's enough to kind of satisfy the competitive instinct within?
I think it definitely, I think as I've, kind of gone through this transition, one thing I've really realized is that I love riding my bike with people. And when I was in Nice for the last 7 years, I probably did less than 10 rides by myself. I always tried to meet someone for a ride, even if it was just for an hour of a 5-hour ride, just to have, that time with other people and to communicate, because that's oftentimes, the only socialization that you would get during a day. So these events, while some of them are definitely competitive, you look at Belgian Waffle or, Dirty Kansas, those are competitive events, and even some of the endurance events are timed. But to that, I think personally being there and being with people and, kind of over time slowly changing my mindset to not feel like I need to, I don't need to win everything. There's events that I'll definitely target, but there's a lot of events I would love to just go to and participate. And that's one of the beautiful aspects of cycling, is that there are so many different realms to access and to see and people to meet. And oftentimes at a lot of these events, you know, the stories that you hear and the people you connect with are far greater than the results you achieve.
We heard in a recent episode of the Cycling Podcast the circumstances which have led to you deciding to retire from elite road racing. Did the fact that there is this other whole world of opportunity out there, was that a factor in helping make that decision a little bit easier to come to terms with? I know obviously from the health point of view, you know, it was largely kind of pushing you in one direction anyway, but the fact that there is another world to cycling that's just kind of, it seems that it's on the upslope at the moment, did that make it easier to reconcile the decision?
Yeah, I mean, you know, racing has always been my target, my focus. You know, all these other, you know, areas of cycling have always kind of been in the corner of my eye, but seemed not really accessible with the career I had. You know, you're so focused and, you know, you're kind of limited by what you can do. And, you know, while you've seen more pro riders go off, you know, Larry and Connor, their no-go tour, and Tim Wellens and De Gendt doing these, you know, bike packing tours is awesome, but it's really hard to fit into a calendar. But no, I'm really excited to get involved in some different events and, you know, kind of, like I said, discover the bike in a new way. And I'm excited to, you know, one of the things I've really realized is that I'm really out of my element here. And I'm, to a large degree, a very newbie at this kind of form of cycling, which is, you know, kind of put down that guard and that ego of being a pro road racer and to be vulnerable and say, hey, listen, I don't know anything about bike tour and I don't know about tire pressure for different events. You know, can the average person who's participated in some of these events multiple times, like, they're all of a sudden my, you know, wealth of knowledge.
Yeah. Are you anticipating a kind of, you know, a raised eyebrow? You know, yeah, it's not so easy, Ian, when there's no mechanic to sort your bike out for you.
Yeah, well, that's something I definitely need to learn. I was actually out in an event in California in mid-November, and I got a flat tire, and, you know, I was like, oh man, I can fix this quickly. And it was tubeless, and I didn't know anything about it, and I had a threaded core to my inner tube, and I had a threaded pump, so every time I unthreaded the pump, it pulled the core out. So I was like, oh man, I need to do a course in kind of basic bike mechanics just to learn, you know, some of this mechanical skill.
And just on the sort of overlap between the pro road racing world and this other world, you mentioned Connor, Larry, Tim Wellens, Thomas De Gendt, and they're off the beaten track, unsupported rides. But EF Education First have embraced this world as well with a formal alternative calendar. And we understand that last week the man who founded the Eroica in Tuscany, Giancarlo Brocci, has met with the UCI president, David Lepartion, to talk about trying to come up with a calendar of races that go off the beaten track, taking in gravel, little-known roads, and really kind of almost restoring the early pioneering spirit of road racing. 300-kilometer races, I mean, you know, road racing has gone away from that in recent years, but there seems to be a movement to kind of restore that epic, undiscovered quality to it.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because I was actually on a call last week with some people at USA Cycling, because they, you know, to a degree have kind of missed this boat of alternative racing in the US. All of a sudden, you have these huge numbers of people at these events, but they don't need there's no license that needs to be purchased. There's no governing body that oversees it. There's no real rules outside, you know, kind of guidelines that the race promoter, you know, suggests or enforces, you know, helmets and whatnot. But it'll be interesting to see, because I know that to a large degree, this kind of space is relatively unsanctioned. And I think a lot of people in this area do have almost a fear or an apprehension of, you know, governing bodies, you know, and someone like the UCI stepping in and trying to take control of it. Because I think people are drawn to this because it is so free and because there aren't any rules kind of pertaining to equipment. And, you know, does my gravel bike, do I have to have my saddle, you know, 5 centimeters behind the bottom bracket? And that allows, because there aren't those rules and regulations, it allows people on all sorts of equipment to ride. You know, my wife and I organized an event here in Vermont, and the amount of people on different bikes that participated was incredible. You know, we had people on, you know, $10,000 custom bikes, and we had people on, you know, 30-year-old town bikes with, you know, a semi-knobby tire. and they're all riding together. And for me, that was incredible to see, you know, coming from a background where your equipment is so important, and it still is, but to see people, you know, getting out there and riding their bikes because they have a bike and they're not limited by, you know, any sort of rules.
Well, that strikes me as it being very egalitarian and inclusive, really.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's, you know, one of the awesome things about this is you're kind of, you know, you're not bound by these, you know, regulations, which allows people to ride whatever they want or whatever they seek fit to be the best bike for that event. You know, there's kind of a term that people use in these alternative races, like there's no bike that's perfect for an entire event. You know, it's sometimes you're on a single track and you wish you had a mountain bike, and another time you're on a climb and you wish you had a road bike. So you kind of got to pick the best equipment for that event and for your strengths.
Well, Ian, you're going to be contributing to our Explore series over the course of the year. We're going to be checking in with you, finding out what you've been doing and what you've got coming up. But just looking at the year ahead, what kind of stories are you hoping to be able to tell us?
Well, so I'm kind of looking at broadening my horizon as far as speaking to people who, you know, are kind of pioneers or, you know, kind of, you know, legends of this space of alternative racing and alternative riding. Even doesn't necessarily have to be focused on the gravel racing, but people who have done bike tours, people who, you know, kind of live their life through a bike that's coming from a different world that I come from, and, you know, how can we share their stories, which is, you know, fascinating to me as I, you know, become more informed on this space. I'm continually impressed to see what people are doing on a bike, and that's really inspiring to me, and to see what I can do and how I can join them.
Now, you're going from the really kind of strict, regimented world of road racing, where somebody else decides what time you start and tells you what route to take, and you know, it's your job to get from A to B as quickly as possible, into a slightly, you know, more relaxed world, in the sense that I know there are some events that are point to point, but you can take whatever route you want. I know certainly there's events like that over here in Europe. I'm sure there is over in the States. But you're kind of going initially into the world of organized events that take you off the beaten track. But have you ever, during your racing days, when you're riding the Grand Tours, have you ever fantasized about just taking off with as much as you can carry and touring round? Were there days on the Tour de France where you looked up a road off to the right or the left and wondered where that went to, and thought, well, maybe one day I'll get to come back and just explore the countryside for myself?
Definitely. You know, that's, and actually I actually have done a bike tour before. Back in 2015, I'm not to say I influenced Larry or, you know, Tim Wellens, but my brother, myself, and Nathan Earle, who was at Team Sky at the time, did a bike trip in Nice in July of 2015. We left from Nice and we got these little panniers for our race bikes. And all we carried in there was, you know, a t-shirt, pair of swim trunks, flip-flops, and we each had one kit. And we did a five-day tour through the Alps into Italy over... you know, Col de Vars, over Col d'Agnello, and then back around to Nice. So I've dabbled with it before. You know, this was a very, I don't want to say luxurious tour, because we only had one kit and, you know, a swimsuit, but, you know, we had showers and we had, you know, we weren't packing our own stuff. But it's definitely something that, you know, I'd love to do more, because just that mindset of waking up every morning and just realizing my only goal is to get to where I'm going. And it doesn't really matter how long it takes to get there. It's about what you see along the way, and, you know, stopping and jumping in a river and getting a, you know, a full lunch on a rod, something probably right up your alley. But it's definitely something that I would love to do again. And I'm actually was messaging with a friend yesterday, who invited me out to a bike tour in Baja, Mexico in late April. So he's been inviting me on these trips all over the world for a couple of years now. And, you know, I've always had to deny and, you know, say no, because I can't, you know, I just didn't have the time and didn't really fit into my calendar and into my training. But all of a sudden that world's opened up to me. It's like, hey, yeah, I have a couple of weeks free. Let's ride into Mexico and tour around and pack all of our camp gear.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Explore is supported by Science in Sport, who provide just the fuel you need, whether you're racing, training, or just going on a long bike ride. Now, for me, one of the joys of a long distance bike ride is the feeling of having earned a nice meal at the end of the day. But while you're actually on the road, it's often nice to know you've got some specifically designed products tucked away in your back pocket or handlebar bag so you can refuel efficiently on the road. That's where Science in Sport's bars and gels come into their own. And if you're riding back-to-back days, you also want to make sure that you're replacing everything you've burned during the day, which is where a sachet of Science in Sport's Rego powder is perfect for your recovery. Just mix it up into a sort of milkshake-like drink and you feel as fresh as new the next morning. All of our listeners can get 25% off at scienceinsport.com by using the code SISCP25 at the checkout. That's SISCP25. Well, Hannah, Ian Boswell, a rider I always thought would be a great fit for EF Education First, but he's retiring from pro road racing, but he's kind of following in the wheel tracks of some of the EF Education First riders who last year took themselves off the beaten track somewhat.
Yeah, so this was kind of an initiative or goal of the team last year was they wanted to kind of start and look to compete or ride some of the races that felt a bit more grassroots and a bit more connected to the fans of cycling, and kind of almost like break down barriers a little bit between what the World Tour teams can sometimes have with their fans. So they decided to go into races like Dirty Kanza, Leadville, Lachlan Morton also rode GB Douro, which is this crazy race that starts from Land's End and finishes in John O'Groats, but it's mainly all off-road and over gravel tracks. And he was literally cycling 500 miles and then sleeping in a bivy bag in a ditch and falling into like cow feces or really getting into the spirit of things. And it's been quite interesting to see the team, like the ones who were not quite as into it or interested in some of these alternative races, it's also turned some of their heads and they've actually decided that actually this is something that's really good fun and they could potentially see themselves doing something if they can fit it in amongst kind of their road racing that they have. So yeah, all in all, it was a really successful year. Our main guys were Lachlan and Alex and Taylor, who really got stuck in and they absolutely loved it. And the other thing that was quite impressive is just because they came from the World Tour, it didn't mean that they could turn up to these kind of races and just go in there and sort of like wipe the floor with everyone. That was very far from the actual case, especially with the gravel races like Dirty Kanza and the mountain bike race with Leadville. So, yeah, some really interesting and fun tales that they had to tell by the end of the year.
Yeah, that was one of the things I was struck by talking to Ian, was the sort of level of respect he has for people who do very different types of cycling to the cycling that earned him his living in the World Tour peloton, and not taking it lightly, not assuming that he's going to turn up at some of these events and automatically be among the best just because he's, you know, ridden the Tour de France and the other Grand Tours. So I think breaking down barriers is a good way of thinking of it, because I think that, you know, from us on the outside watching the Tour de France and the other great races, the classics, they're the things that do inspire you to go and ride some of those roads, aren't they? You know, everyone's, you know, whether they've had the opportunity to do so or not, everyone would love to go and ride in the Alps or go and ride the cobbled climbs in Flanders. And I think this broadens people's horizons, this kind of initiative, and makes people think of cycling as a more sort of joined up sport rather than one that's compartmentalized and that there are sort of invisible walls between, you know, people who ride with certain types of tires or certain shaped handlebars. So yeah, all good stuff, and we will be following Ian's journey throughout the year, and no doubt, Hannah, you can keep us up to date with what the riders at EF Education First are doing. But I think it's time to get back to my conversation with Felicity Cloak. My stomach has stopped grumbling, and so this is us completing her culinary Tour de France.
Pause Café. French opening hours, a fun guessing game for all the family. A subject so esoteric it deserves a nice sit down with a café crème. Though really, the general rule can be summed up in three words: trust no one. French opening hours are a law unto themselves, and even when they are available online or printed on the door of the actual establishment, they're rarely respected, so this can only ever be a rough guide, and I will accept no responsibility for starvation due to reliance on it. French bakeries and cafes tend to open early, around 6:30 to 7 a.m, for obvious reasons, but like most shops, banks and even post offices, they close somewhere between 12 and 1 and don't reopen until 3:30 at the earliest. The same goes for most tourist attractions, save churches. The last are, of course, open on Sunday, but many shops aren't, and even big supermarkets that boast of being 7 jours sur 7 are actually only open on Sunday morning, because the French take the work-life balance seriously, and so should you, even if it takes you 3 weeks to appreciate 3 hours of enforced idleness in the middle of the day. Restaurants keep opposite hours. They will generally open for lunch at noon or shortly beforehand. The sanctity of l'heure de déjeuner between 12 and 2 is very noticeable for anyone travelling on French roads. More than once, I nearly got run over by the lunchtime rush to get home to eat, and will usually stop serving about 1:30. So unless you're in a big city with a brasserie non-stop or can find a McDonald's, don't expect to get fed after that time. Dinner is usually eaten between 7 and 9, though people in cities and further south may push this slightly later. Many smaller shops and bakeries are closed on Mondays as well, and the entire country seems to take its summer holiday in August. Be aware, most things will be shut on May Day, Bastille Day, 14th of July, and to a lesser extent, the Feast of the Ascension, a movable feast, 39 days after Easter Sunday, in addition to the usual Christmas, New Year and Easter holidays. And there are a couple more regional feasts in Alsace too. Apart from that little list though, you ought to find at least half the places you want to visit open. Note: I always find counting to 10 before kicking a shuttered door very calming.
Just rolling back a little bit there, you mentioned the creperie in Brittany, where they were kind of surprised that you were ringing to make a reservation 6 months in advance or several months in advance. The great contradiction of France is that some places will be surprised that you're trying to reserve in advance, and some places will be aghast that you haven't reserved 6 months in advance. And the opening hours is a recurring theme in the book, and it's something we struggle with on the Tour de France. On the rest day in Castres this year, I booked a table for lunch, and we were told we had to be there before 1:15. I thought, well, we're running a bit late, I'm sure we'll be fine. We got there about 1:25 and they said, sorry, lunch is finished. 1:25. I mean, what's wrong with these people?
Yeah, it's so interesting. And when I sort of got quite slightly more wise to it by the end if I was on my own, but I just couldn't make people that had come from the UK understand that you can't just have two, you know, small beers or whatever for lunch. You need to sit down and actually have it, even though you're not particularly hungry at that point, because, you know, I eat lunch late. And I think the British, I found it interesting, I did the Hebrides, cycled the Hebridean Way a few months ago, and you wouldn't say that the Outer Hebrides was a hotbed of sort of culinary exoticism, but it's very easy to get, you know, a decent, you know, you have a cheese scone, a black pudding roll at all times of day, and there are some great cafes, you know, some seafood soup, etc. Much easier than the entire of France to get food when you want food.
France is a country, as the hexagon, you can divide it up into all sorts of irregular shapes according to the dishes, you know, bouillabaisse in Marseille, cassoulet in, well, Toulouse and Castelnaudry, as you say, you know, the tartiflette in the Alps, and the charolais beef, and then the schwein knuckle and sauerkraut in the Alsace. There's still very strong regional identities and a real pride with the regional dishes, and obviously the book is all about the, you know, lots of little arguments about what goes in things, particularly cassoulet and bouillabaisse. We'll come on to cassoulet, a personal favourite of mine, but I'll save that for the end. Do you feel that's a generational thing, or do you think that the habits of the young French are changing as you went around the country? Could you sort of see, particularly comparing back to kind of childhood holidays, can you see the culture changing a bit?
I don't see it changing very fast in my experience, because it did seem, you know, you do get, what I found interesting was that the things that, apart from, you know, your classic French pizzeria, which I don't think of as un-French because they really have taken the pizza and made it into something very un-Italian, apart from down on the Côte d'Azur. But otherwise, the sort of the interlopers do tend to be sort of takeaways and fast food joints. And you know, the French restaurant is still seems to see the Bistro de Brasserie still seems to be the cornerstone of where you would go to eat, you know, for a proper meal. And if you go into, you know, your big supermarket, you know, not your bijou little delicatessen, you'll still find great displays of local food and local cheeses, and people still seem to be really passionate about those things. And whoever I engaged in conversation, you know, I admit I didn't really talk to any children, but people of any age, because I'd always try and chat to people, you know, at hotel receptions, at campsites, whatever, and they all had recommendations and they felt strongly. And I don't know whether in the UK, because I don't tend to do that so much because I'm not a foreigner there, and therefore I guess you just don't do that in your own country. I don't know whether people would have such strong opinions about where the best place to eat that is, or what the proper constituents of a, you know, a cassoulet or whatever are. But I think it's still alive and pretty well. I'd suspect that the frozen chips are probably no worse than they were in the 80s. I mean, some of it is looking a bit tired, but I don't know whether that's any worse than it ever was. I can't believe that there was ever a time where everything in France was amazing. So,
but they've held back the tide of the chain restaurants, which we obviously haven't done here.
Yeah, and also the only thing that I would say is that you have your regional specialities, and that's great. But otherwise, I found, and you will have more experience than me on this, is that you go to these little, you know, restaurants where almost everything is made at home, but the menus across France are incredibly similar, and they're very, you know, your fish, slightly overcooked white fish in white sauce with your green beans that I've come to realise are not overcooked, they're just French style rather than British style, and just because they're grey, that doesn't mean they're bad. But there's that, you know, there's the tête de veau, which, you know, I'm very keen on, but can be done quite badly. And, you know, your the andouillette, which is everywhere. And these things, they're great, and they're very French. You wouldn't find any of those on a menu in the UK, I don't think. And to some extent, that's good. They haven't been swayed by the sort of, well, largely haven't been swayed by the sort of Instagrammable trend, or the let's grab this from, you know, Thailand and put it with something from Mexico. But those sort of dishes, I do wonder how long they can survive, and whether it is slightly stymieing sort of culinary innovation, because you just get the same things done well, but not amazingly, everywhere.
I wasn't going to mention andouillette, but now you've said the word, I've got to ask what you make of it.
I started off, I've had it a few times before, because I don't like not liking food. I feel it as a shame, and I also feel a slight national embarrassment, because I feel like, you know, it's like when you order a steak tartare in France and the waiter says, oh, madame, you know it's raw. Yes, I know it's raw. And then I feel like I have to finish the entire thing just to prove, even though it's massive, just to prove that it's not freaked me out. So there's a sort of defensiveness about me trying it all the time. And I remember actually on the 2017 trip in Brittany, they had this sort of cured andouillette, which is beautiful because it's got lots of different swirls of intestines and layers, and it's cut very thin. I bought some at a supermarket. No one else that I was with, they smelt it and then said no. And even I couldn't manage that much of it. But, you know, it was a more approachable way of the andouillette, because it wasn't warm. And obviously the flavour, the sort of the scent of the andouillette does increase as the temperature rises. And so anyway, this time when I was in Lyon, I went to a Bouchon, and I had a big group of adventurous eaters with me in Lyon. Surprise, surprise, everyone wanted to come and cycle Burgundy with me. And so I said, well, I'm in charge of ordering. You're not allowed any, apart from there was one girl that was pregnant. And I said, you can have what you like. I won't judge you. Everyone else, you need to have what I'm having. So we ordered everything at this Bouchon. And one of the things was an andouillette. And I don't know whether it's because I've been in France for so long, or because this was a particularly good stroke mild andouillette. I'm sure the French wouldn't conflate the two. But it also came with a lovely sharp mustard sauce. And I suddenly realised, and it was a bit like when I realised that the point of tofu is not the flavour, it's the texture. I sort of realised that actually the texture of andouillette, once you've made peace with the fact that it's got a lot of unusual textures in it, it's a bit frilly, it's a bit chewy, ooh, it's sort of like a, you know, never the same bite twice. That's quite interesting to eat, but you have to make peace with that, and that takes a while. And I enjoyed that, and it was pride that I made us finish it, but I did quite enjoy it. And there were some other things on the table that were also texturally problematic. So yeah, I think I'd say that now I'm slightly agnostic.
Well, I'm further back down the course on that particular journey. I've tried and I've given up on the Andouillette. For those who aren't aware, I have talked about it on the podcast before. It's a tripe sausage, and I've described it as being like rubber bands packed into a Veruca sock with a cup full of drain water. It always comes with a sharp steak knife, and it's that first pierce of the thick skin and the vapour that comes out that really... I can't get over that. I struggle from that point on, really. It really gets no better for me. And I do warn people. I mean, try it by all means. You're a better man or woman than I am if you try it a second time. So fair play to you, Felicity. I was going to finish up with the cassoulet, because it's a passion of mine, mainly inherited from my dad, who used to make them at home. And they used to, you know, again, another kind of culinary awakening went from the what's that disgusting smell to, oh, this is, you know, this is good. And then becoming a sort of connoisseur, and then being taken to school, really, by Francois about cassoulet and actually learning about it and then making it myself as well. It's one of those dishes that, again... sometimes it can be really, really good, but it's become so kind of such a motif on menus that you pick up this sort of unwritten signs of where it might be good or not. A good sign to me is when it warns you might have to wait 25 minutes. A bad sign is when it's just on the menus sort of the whole year round. I mean, what appeals, because it's a very heavy, hearty dish, but to me it's the French countryside of the southwest, and it's something that, unlike the tartiflette, genuinely does go back probably centuries.
I did the 2017 trip, because we went sort of via Carcassonne. In fact, I think we did the three there, and I had three, the Carcassonne, the Castelnaudary, and the Toulouse cassoulet. And that was in August, I found it interesting, because I'd obviously had cassoulet before, and I'd made it and I'd written a recipe for it, so I'd tried lots of different versions, and what I found interesting is when you write about it, as I guess if you write about it as anyone that's not from that region, you absorb the sort of basically the myth of cassoulet, that the three different versions that were famously described by Montaigne as the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost of, you know, cassoulet, and one of them has lamb and one of them has duck confit or goose confit, and etc. And when you actually get to those places, you find as many different variations. You know, you can quite easily get a Toulouse sausage, you know, in Carcassonne. You'll find the duck confit in various places. You'll find lamb. It's complete rubbish as far as I can tell. And looking at recipes from sort of respected chefs of that region, they'll seem to chuck in just whatever they fancy. So I think the myth of it being this sort of three monolithic dishes is rubbish, but you're right in the sense that I realised this time that I think the sign of a good cassoulet is it hasn't been, you want it to have been sitting in the oven to long enough that it's, you know, it's thickened and, you know, it's really rich and the flavours have all sort of infused and, you know, it's a good layer of animal fat of some sort on those beans, but you don't want it having been in there for so long that it's basically turned really gummy and gluey, because, you know, there's a place for that sort of stodge, but actually I don't think it's in cassoulet. And I was schooled in this by an elderly French man that watched me eat one in Toulouse and then leaned over and asked me how it was and then gave me a lecture about the fact that even though it's usually good at this place, he didn't think mine looked good and etc, etc. And I was like, oh, okay. And so then I started to look and think, yeah, maybe it was. I had a one in Castelnaudary that evening and one made the next evening, and it was looser, and I thought actually this is a bit nicer because it's quite a heavy dish anyway. It's nicer to have a little bit of liquid. The one thing that I found funny was in that kind of dish I would be inclined to eat some sort of vegetable matter with it, and I would always order a green salad on the side. The outrage that without exception was shown when I tried to do that. I'd say, no, you don't need it, madame, you know, this is a complete dish. And I'd say, but nevertheless, I would like a green salad. They'd say, for a starter. I said, no, with it. And they were just, you know, they said, they allowed me because I'm foreign and, you know, I was completely mad. But they did not like it, and people would just stop and watch me eat. You know, being a woman on your own in a restaurant working your way through a cassoulet and some wine. And, you know, in general, one of the things I like about France is that you can eat on your own and no one looks twice. But dressed in lycra, eating a cassoulet with a salad, that does attract a little bit of attention.
But it was just the salad that was controversial. Yes. I imagine Madame went back to the kitchen and tutted, and the chef downed all his cutlery. I can't attribute this line, but it sums up Cassoulet to me. The beans must be broken down, yet still intact.
Mm, yeah, you need that sort of the mushiness inside, but the whole thing shouldn't be a mush. It's sort of like our own proud heritage of baked beans. In my opinion, you want to reduce those a little. You don't want them straight out of the can, but you don't want them to become a sort of slurry across your toast. I mean, obviously, there's two baked beans from a tin, and Cassoulet are very analogous.
Paris, of course, like any cosmopolitan capital city, is a place where you can eat yourself around the globe, but my ambitions are more modest. I'm hoping, as a crescendo of my trip, to achieve croissant nirvana in a city of light. Certainly, I'll have eaten enough of the things by then to judge what's good and what's not. I'm intending to put away at least one a day, barring any more interesting offers. Pause Café. The croissant rating system. Pay attention, because you're going to be seeing a lot more of this. I started rating croissants on the coast-to-coast trip of 2017 for no better reason than that they're reliably found throughout France. I enjoy overthinking food, and most importantly, I like them. The perfect croissant is, of course, entirely a matter of taste. Professional pâtissiers put a lot of store by the lamination of the dough, or how skillfully the pastry and butter have been folded together to create hundreds of distinct layers. According to one equation I find online, the average croissant has 649. Me, I'm less concerned with looks. Some of the most disappointing pastries I've eaten in London are the ones flaunting their perfect strata of dough all over social media, but which turn out to have very little in the way of flavour. What I look for in a good croissant is 1. Butteriness. No margarine-based croissant for me. 2. A good balance of caramelised sweetness and bready, savoury notes. 3. A crisp base. 4. A slightly damp middle, squidgy, but not doughy. In the text that follows, all scores are out of 10. 1 to 4 denotes a poor croissant, not even worth finishing. A croissant contains about 260 calories. 5 to 7 as a mediocre to decent example, not worth complaining about. An 8 plus as a good croissant worth repeating immediately if time permits.
This journey it's called One More Croissant for the Road, and I thought that was a clever motif to kind of, you can tell a lot about the cuisine and the country and the type of place you are by how well they do the absolute staple. I mean, you can't get more French than a croissant, but the variety was, I mean, you had some real stinkers and obviously some good examples, and you have your own criteria, nice crisp bottom, soft in the middle but not wet. Good colour, not particularly bothered about the shape. I think you know, taste and texture are more important than whether it's a neat mass-produced crescent. But clearly, that was you could almost plot your way around France and see a real humble place and get the best croissant and see a kind of place that looks the part but actually not get a best croissant. And it kind of does and doesn't give you many clues when you're going out to sort of search for places. You develop an almost a sixth sense about these things after a few summers in France, I think.
Yeah, and I found it interesting, not only that croissant is one of the things that you can reliably get everywhere in France, except for some places that don't have any boulangeries. But also, I think the most expensive one I had was in Paris, and I think it was still only, it was maybe, I don't think it topped €2. And there's that thing, it's very democratic. You know, this place that I got it, I had some really incredible croissant in Paris. But this place looked like a jewellery shop. You know, everything was sort of black and spotlit, and I mean, it was amazing, it was so beautiful. And the croissant was actually excellent, which I was sort of disappointed by because I wanted to think it was style over substance, but it had both. But, you know, even then it was still absurdly cheap. And the amount you would pay for the same thing in London is just, you know, I think, you know, £4 or £5, maybe not £5, but, you know, nearly £4 for a really good croissant. And I just thought that's the great thing about France, that you don't have to be able to afford this amazing cake. And food in general in France is slightly more expensive than the UK for various reasons, not all of them bad. But the croissant was just so democratic, and I just love the fact that you can just, you know, you buy one, you can stick it in your panniers, you know, ride out of town and go and just sit by the side of the road or something and eat your croissant. And it's just so nice doing that. You take it to a little cafe, and I think that's a really civilised thing. You buy your croissant, you take it to a cafe, you have a of coffee, you watch the market or whatever's happening. And they were probably some of the happiest times of the trip. I was just watching the world go by eating croissants. It's just amazing.
It's a bit like Italy and the €1 espresso. If they try and make a croissant €2.50 in France, the boulangeries will be covered in bedsheets with slogans written on them, and the public will have gone on strike.
It's true. And someone said to me, because I was asking, when I got to Paris, I did do a bit of research about the croissants there, because mostly, you know, you don't have much choice when you're cycling. As I said, you just go to what you pass. In Paris, I had a lot of choice. And so I did a bit of research. I found there's actually a really good Google map. Someone's put in their best croissants in Paris, or, you know, Figaro's possibly best croissants in Paris. And I asked people that I know that live in Paris, and they said, well, to be honest, I know the ones in my area, but no one in Paris would travel really. It's not like London, where you see people sort of queuing up outside places for hours to get this particular thing. They said, you know, you've got your local boulangeries, patisseries, and you will go to the one that you happen to think is best, but you're not going to, it's not worth the price of a metro fare to go and get a croissant. That's just not what we do. And I found that really interesting, because it just shows that sort of, that the general standard is high, because it's not like these people aren't fussy. They, you know, people I know in general are quite fussy about food, but they just didn't see the need. They support their local person and he's good. And I just found that so, it really made me want to relocate.
And when you kind of got to the end of the journey and got home and reflected on it and then wrote the book, how important was it that this was a journey you did by bike? Because naturally it slows you down, it forces you to take things in more slowly.
I think that I could have only done this particular journey by bike. And actually I was talking to about the possibility of doing another book along the same lines, and whether there would be, you know, be another walking or whatever. I said, there's nothing that does it. Walking, you are going slowly, obviously. You don't see you take in a lot of details, but you don't see things change. I think with cycling, it's unique because you're going slowly enough to pick up stuff, to look at roadside signs. You can stop whenever you like. You know, you can even go off-road if required, although my least favourite thing to do on the trip was end up in a Google Maps sort of mud bath. But also it's fast enough that you really see the landscape change. And in the course of a day, you know, when I was going from the Champagne region into Paris, and I just, you know, you see the landscape change and you see the signs for the champagne houses slowly dwindle and et cetera, et cetera. And even stuff like, you know, you might start off and you have, you know, butter on the table at lunch with your bread without asking, and, you know, people drinking cider. And then suddenly you start to see, you know, the butter disappear and, you know, the bread to be dry. People are drinking little wines or whatever. And the first time I saw someone drinking pastis in the morning, I was like, oh, yes, I've made it. And so I just think recycling is the perfect taste for that, but also that you can feel the landscape beneath you, and so you know very much that you're heading towards the Pyrenees because stuff starts to climb. I just, there's no substitute for that. And also, of course, cycling does give you a real appetite, and I just felt like, I mean, I don't feel guilty about food generally, luckily, but I just, you know, I really felt that I could order whatever I liked. If I could find food, then I would totally eat it. And the French also love cyclists. They're just, I could never get over the fact of how enthusiastic they are to see someone at bike, how courteous they are, how they will, and this sounds like a cliche, but it's true, people would come out of their houses occasionally in rural areas if they saw me and sort of wave and say bravo and chapeau and etc. And that's really lovely. So I think that, yeah, being a woman on her own on a bike asking about food is basically the way to make friends in France.
It doesn't matter how far you've come and how far you're going, whether it's a short distance or a long distance, they always seem quite impressed that you've got there under your own steam on a bike.
Yeah, and also on the very last, I finished at the Arc de Triomphe, which was a mistake because it felt, you know, felt right, but also I hadn't really thought about when the Arc de Triomphe and the Champs-Élysées is not closed to traffic. Actually, that's quite a scary roundabout. So anyway, I'm a London cyclist, so I just pulled out and hoped for the best. And I met a friend there, and, you know, we had some champagne, etc. And then I got turfed off by a very officious woman who said, you're not allowed bikes here, you know, get off. And so we were, packing up, etc. And then these two policemen came over, and I was just like, oh, God, to say, it's like, you know, we're going, don't worry. And they said, no, we want to know, you know, how far have you come? Because I still had all my panniers and things, and I probably looked a bit road worn by that point. And they wanted to know all about my route, and they were just so interested. And they said, don't worry about her, stay as long as you like. And that was so nice. And so, you know, there's lots of pretty bureaucracy in France, but actually in general, I just love the fact that people are enthusiastic about cyclists and they're enthusiastic about talking to you, which is something in London that you don't get. And that made me fall in love with the country all over again.
So have you got another trip on the horizon? Is it something you'll do again?
I hope so. I mean, I've got you mentioned Ventoux earlier. This friend who moved down to back to her family farm is actually right underneath Ventoux. And she has been sending me repeated messages saying, we can do it, we can do it. And I'm thinking, I don't know, again, can I do it? Do I need to maybe do some training for that? Yes. And so that's on the horizon as a sort of hazy plan. I mean, she's saying, this, you know, the three routes up or whatever, we can do all of them in a week. And I'm thinking, if I do it once, I'll be delighted. But yeah, there's possibly another book in the pipeline. The hard thing is, because France is so perfect in all regards, food, cycling, you know, etc. And I love France so much. It's picking where to go next. But I had a really great time cycling in the Hebrides, so it might be somewhere closer to home. I need to buy a map.
Hannah, I make no apology for focusing on the food as much as the cycling in this first episode of the revamped Explore. I mean, you've got to keep eating to keep the pedals turning, haven't you? So the two go hand in hand.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, to be honest with you, I think it's one of the best ways to start, Lionel, because at the end of the day, when I listened to Felicity talk about her trip around France, it really, really made me think, oh, where would I want to go? And which kind of country would I want to go to and ride around to explore the cuisine? I'm not sure, if I'm honest, it would be France. I mean, I love the riding. I'm just not the biggest fan of French cuisine. Eek, I don't know whether I should really say that or admit to that. But apart from the croissant, I'm a big fan of the croissant, though. And I did find that bit really interesting where she was saying, or where you look to find the staple of a country and when they do it well. And I literally was out for a ride at the weekend with a friend, and we stopped for a croissant and a coffee in a nice little plaza just south of Barcelona. And I actually said, this is my favourite part of a ride, is sitting down in the sun with a coffee and a croissant. It just doesn't get any better. That's, for me, the pinnacle of the ride.
I couldn't agree more, Hannah. Even when I was listening to you talk about Lachlan Morton, you know, bedding down in a bivy bag amongst the cow feces, I thought, well, I don't particularly want to do that, but I certainly want to seek out good places to eat. And, you know, when you're on a ride, well, why not? I think French cuisine gets a bad rap from some people. And I think perhaps you and I are similar in the sense that when we're away at the Tour de France, we're often not in a great position to pick and choose the finest places to eat because we're working late. I mean, your experiences must be pretty hit and miss because you're at the mercy of the hotels that the team are staying in. The riders, of course, will have perfect food prepared for them by the team chef, no doubt. But the staff, I guess you're just picking off the menu 9 times out of 10.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And of course, the riders, they have chef cooks for them every day. But I think last year we were at the Tour de France and one of our sports directors, at one point, he pushed his plate away from him after the waiter had pushed it had put it down in front of him. And he was like, I can't eat duck à l'orange for the third night in a row. I just can't do it.
Oh dear, that reminds me of spending time in a French hotel with another pro team, not your team EF Education First, but another team a few years ago, and we were served up by the hotel something that looked, I couldn't really tell what the meat was, and it was Nicolas Portal actually who basically asked what was the meat, and somebody said it's chicken, and then there were some horrified faces around the table because it really was very pink in the middle. And then fortunately we got clarification and were told that it was lapin, rabbit. So not not quite as essential to cook that all the way through. But I think all the staff around the table were thinking a bout of food poisoning was heading their way. And there were certainly envious glances across at the sort of cuisine that the riders were enjoying, because, you know, the chef is dedicated to preparing the best possible stuff for them. But I think the thing about Felicity's journey, Hannah, was that she knew what she was doing. She knew where she was heading. She knew the dishes she wanted to sample, and she headed to the best possible places to go and eat that kind of food, which is, as I say, not something that we have the luxury of during our everyday work. But maybe one day, would you fancy a bike packing trip round even France and go and have your mind changed about French cuisine?
I mean, I'm definitely up for that. I like the story that she mentions where she kind of booked almost a month in advance to go and eat at a creperie. And things like that. So I would be up for being converted, that's for sure. But like you said, at the moment my mindset on it is it just doesn't quite have enough vegetables for me. It's a little bit too meaty.
That's a fair point. When you're travelling around at the Tour de France or at any of the races in Europe or outside Europe, I know you're off to Colombia very shortly. I mean, do you get a chance to do much cycling at all? Or are you kind of looking out of the car window wistfully wondering where that particular road goes to and making a mental note, perhaps even keeping a diary of places to go back and ride one day in the future?
Yeah, actually, I remember I was listening to the diaries of James Knox and Nick Schultz last year that you had at the Vuelta. And James Knox was saying that he actually drops pins or does adds to his favourite locations on Google when he's been to a place that really appeals to him. And so on top of that, I started doing that as well as I started going around at the Vuelta. And because the other thing is, otherwise, you know yourself, you just pass through things and you're constantly moving. You literally feel like you don't spend any longer than 12 hours in one particular place. So it's always good to be able to know where you've been and then know where you'd actually like to try and go back and visit at some point on a little bit more relaxed time schedule.
Yeah, and I think the point Felicity made about how she couldn't have done this kind of journey at any other pace than cycling. Walking, of course, it's too slow. You'd struggle to walk around front. I mean, you could do it, obviously, but it wouldn't be the same. And driving, you're not as in touch with the environment. You're not as embedded in the countryside and the culture. And you, while you do notice the countryside changing, you don't pick up on the subtlety of how, you know, one region's gradually becomes another. There's something about travelling by bike which is the absolutely perfect pace for this kind of exploration. So, as I said, Hannah, I promise not every episode will be dominated by my thoughts of lunch, but I can't promise that when I undertake whatever my challenge is later on this year, that there won't be some kind of culinary aspect to it. But maybe some of the listeners have got an idea for something that I could go and ride. I mean, keep it sensible. I'm getting on a bit now and I don't get a chance to do a great lot of cycling, but I'd certainly like to do something, you know, spanning, 4 or 5 days, something like that. So if anyone's got any ideas of where I should go riding, drop us a line or send us a tweet. Well, that's a wrap for episode one of Explore for 2020. We'll be back again next month and every month after that. And well, Hannah, you'll be joining us. We'll have some other voices dropping in and out along the way, and we'll see how we go, shall we? I don't want to plot the journey out too prescriptively in advance. That's the whole beauty of it. We'll see where things take us, I think. So until the next time, thank you very much, Hannah.
Thank you, Lionel. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be an exciting year of meandering.
Excellent. Meandering. That's exactly what it is. This has been an episode of Explore by the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Iwaka. My name is Lionel Burney, and I was joined by Hannah Troop and Ian Boswell. Production was by Tom Wally.
My thanks to Felicity Cloak and her publishers HarperCollins for permission to use extracts from the audiobook version of One More Croissant for the Road. The book is available in print and as an audiobook from all good retailers. And if you like cycling or France or cycling in France, it comes highly recommended. Our theme music is called Coast to Coast by Emil Axelsson. Additional music by Joe E. Lee and Trabant 33. Explore will be back next month. In the meantime, if you want to catch up on past episodes, go to thecyclingpodcast.com/explore.